Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. A lot on the plate today, and that's a pun that I didn't even think of making until it came out of my mouth. Tom Gimbel will be here. He's the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network, and Tom comes from Time to Tithe and to talk about different issues in the workplace. And one of the things we're going to kick around today is this idea of a multi-generational workforce. How do you get the young guns to work, play nice with the older folks in the office, or maybe vice versa? We'll talk to Tom Gimbel about that. Scott Kleinberg will be here. He writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune, and he's talking about today a movement toward contactless ATMs, they're called, I guess, where you can withdraw money from your ATM by using your smartphone, a thumbprint, or things like that, I guess. Not a need for a card. Not sure I understand that, but it's moving into the area, and Scott will talk about that. Right now, Andrea Haynes is here, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation. And Andrea, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
For some time, I have a hard time with Blue Sky Innovation. I have a hard time with terms, I think.
So, plus Blue Sky. If
Blue
you
Sky, okay. Well, I'm glad you're here because you are most Fridays, but this idea of banking without a card, an ATM card, is one thing. But one of the stories I've been reading in Blue Sky is this movement toward software or a startup where they will appeal your property taxes for you without you having to get the documentation. Explain that for me.
Exactly. So they're using, they have law and computer science people on their staffs who will help you appeal your property taxes in exchange for a cut of any savings that you may get because of that appeal.
So that's fair to me. I don't have to pay them to do it. If I get money, I have to give them some of what I receive.
Exactly.
And how does it work?
Something that I think the idea of just doing all the documentation, hiring a lawyer, all that, I think sometimes discourages individuals or condo associations or, whoever
right.
it may be from doing that appeal.
I know it's easier than we think it is just to do it on our own. I mean, I've talked to assessors and others who say it's not that big of a deal, but you're right. Just in your mind, the idea of it is pretty overwhelming. So
I think nowadays anything we can outsource to somebody who will do it for us.
So what's the deal? You just sort of give them your address and they take it from there?
Yeah, I don't actually know exactly what more they need than that. But certainly once you sign up with them, they navigate the process for you, counsel you, and just, figure out what you need without you having to directly hire an attorney.
Now, I live in Lake County, which means I'm out of luck right now, right? It's in Cook County. And it's expanding elsewhere.
Yep, and expanding to other areas. So they got $3 million this week, so they can work on expanding out, and they'll be in other states as well.
Is it a matter of just setting up software?
On their end,
yeah.
And I think they have actual, they have attorneys on staff, people that know the law, and then they sort of plumb the data in order to figure out if you might be due to pay less than you think.
All right, that's called Turbo Appeal, and with any luck at all, it's coming to an assessor's house near you.
Yep.
And let's just keep to the theme then, because I've got this blemish on my face. Do you see it, Andrea?
I don't. I think it's been magically cured.
I don't really want to go to the doctor, but I'd like to have a dermatologist look at it. Hey, there's an app for that.
There is. A Chicago dermatologist has come up with a way to send in a picture, basically, of what you want them to look at. Theory being, you can save a little money, cost being a little less than an office visit, save a little embarrassment if you have something on your face that you, in fact, do not want people to see.
It's so nice of you to not stare at it as
yes.
we talk.
Yes, send in that picture and let them take a look.
Would you take it? Would you mind if I give you my phone? No.
So
that is nice. So then it's nice for the doctor, too, right? Because it will probably take a lot less time for them.
I think so. I imagine in a field like that, there are probably certain things you can tell just by looking. And what the dermatologist was saying is, they would always ask people to come in. Sometimes it's routine or it's something that they just need to quickly look at. And the person's saying, why did I take half a day off work and come here to have you look at this for 3 seconds? Can't I just send a picture kind of thing? So he's trying to do it that way.
Right.
With all these telemedicine things, of course, there's some pushback because there are things where the doctor needs to actually see you. There may be other things they don't notice if they're not seeing you. So it's going to be about striking that balance.
Right. So you might bring something into the office that you're not even aware you're bringing.
I mean, for sure. They might notice something else about you when they're visually examining you that may explain the problem versus just a photo.
The beauty, though, is that this is at least a starting point. I mean, I guess I've been in that situation where I'm like, I don't really think this is anything. Maybe
yeah.
I should go and maybe I'll be more likely to check it out if I do it that way.
I think in recent years, even, they've become more amenable, haven't they, to just hearing by phone what's happening. I think there's a little more you know, maybe a little more latitude in what they're willing to talk to you about over the phone. And of course, then using images as well.
And, I do a lot of email now, which is great too. Yep. So it's called Dermio, I think, is the software. And mm-hmm. You write about a Wicker Park doctor who's got an office in Munster who's using it.
He was with Northwestern until recently, lives in Wicker Park. So he's a Chicagoan, but has opened a practice in Munster, Indiana, right over the state line.
All right. You know, there's a lot of talk about the Oscars and about how they're trying to change their voting makeup or the way they vote, because the controversy this year is, for the second year in a row, no African-Americans nominated in any major of the acting categories. And so Blue Sky took that a step further and looked at the capital markets, right, in Chicago and elsewhere. And what'd you find?
Yep. So stemming out of the Oscars, many professions are confessing that they are, in fact, so white. And that would probably include journalism, we have to admit right now. But venture capital is certainly an area where it's very white, it's very male, and you see a sameness to some of the deals that come out of that world. And so it causes us to ask, what might be happening if there were sort of a different profile here? Would we be seeing different ideas get funding, different ideas get attention, different entrepreneurs rising?
Right. So if you're a venture capitalist, it's in your interest to find what's going to make the most money and work the best. So you would think if you're presented with sort of a minority appeal or minority software that and you think you can make money, you would do it. But there's blind spots there, too.
There's some blind spots. There's also, you know, the people that are coming with the ideas need to be coached and mentored, and that's a part of it. But it also is like you may just not realize things that you don't realize. Right. I had a debate on Twitter this
week. You just
quoted
Donald Rumsfeld there. You don't know. Andrea doesn't know what she doesn't know.
But exactly. It's true. You don't know what you don't know. I had a debate on Twitter this week with somebody over skirt suits. And it was a man who was like, what's a skirt suit? Why would you call it that versus a pantsuit? You know, or why would you call it a pantsuit? You know, and it's like, well, because we also have skirt suits. And it just shows you how, like, that person's mind isn't exactly where yours is. So if I'm pitching a pantsuit, skirt suit, right, he might not go for it because he's not getting the difference.
Andrea?
All about diversity.
I don't know what a skirt suit is.
This could be a whole nother segment. Why do you need to call it a pantsuit, we said. And the women said, because we also have skirt suits.
And what's a skirt suit? A skirt with just a jacket?
A skirt with a jacket. And you can also get a suit that comes with the jacket and pants and a skirt that all match.
But you wouldn't wear them all at the same time.
You probably wouldn't wear them all at the same time. But if I'm pitching that to a white male VC, is he excited about the idea? Or is he like, what are you talking about?
Well, there you go.
Do you really have to coordinate all these outfits?
So we're being a little silly, but not really, because it's exactly what we're talking about.
It's a little bit about that resonance and recognition. And when you have a brief moment to capture someone's attention and to make them understand the problem you're trying to solve, that's exactly the kind of difference that you think if you've got familiar faces on the other end of the table, they're going to understand your problem. They're going to be more likely to resonate with that idea.
Okay, so what's the fix? Because the white guys with the money are going to still be the white guys with the money.
They are. And as you alluded to, as you know, minority markets grow and the population changes, you're going to want to reach those markets as best you can. You can't keep making parking apps, which have kind of become a little bit the cliche, although a wonderful and necessary invention too. So hopefully there'll be some financial motivation to it and, you know, other ways that people will be motivated to reach out. And then that as it starts to happen, the idea is you get one or two founders that make their fortune who are minorities. They're going to then turn around and bring up others.
And there are venture capitalists out there who are trying to make a change when it comes to this, right?
There definitely are. There's some that are realizing, obviously, the financial potential of it and trying to just make sure that they're reaching into those markets and hearing from a variety of founders.
Andrea Haynes, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. I'm Steve Bertrand, sitting across from Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network. Tom Gimbel, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So I just said earlier that we're going to talk about multi-generational office work forces and things like that, and I want to, but we were talking off the air, and you know, we're in the political season, and different people need to make their pitch. We're in a rough start to Wall Street, and you know, no one can argue that. That's not political. The Dow is down. But I keep seeing signs where people are hiring.
Yeah. I think we're seeing it. We've never been, you know, at my company, we've never been busier. We're doing recruiting in 12 cities across the country. Majority of our business is in Chicago, but all over the country, and companies are hiring it in whether it's technology or administrative support, HR, marketing. I mean, it's there are two very different signs coming from what's on, you know, the cable news channels, whether it be on the left or the right. They're all saying those things, and a lot of it fuels from the stock market drop in January, which you alluded to.
Right.
And I think that's, but I haven't seen companies filing for bankruptcy. Right. We're seeing mergers. We're seeing big mergers. So I think that it's changing. But a lot of people want to see the late 90s, want to see the mid 2000s. And you and I have talked about that before. It just isn't going to be a rapid hiring like that across the board anymore.
But, you know, because so much of the economy and so much of the way we walk around is what we think, how, yep. you know, our confidence or things like that. And, you know, when it comes to hiring anyway, things are looking pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just a new normal, right? Without being too cliche, but this is the way life is. And I think too often people who are our age or even, you know, the millennials, everybody's 2 degrees away from somebody who struck it rich.
Right.
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 Either an app or they created a company or whatever it is who's made $1 million in stock options or technology.
I bought a lotto ticket today, just right. so you know.
I didn't win the Powerball, so I'm still here. But I think we look at it.
Would you not be if you'd won the Powerball? You
I'd
wouldn't
still be
here. Thank you very
I'd still
much.
Be here. Unfortunately for my staff, I'd still be at work too. But I think that's what people are looking for of this another huge surge like we had with the .com.
Right.
I got to tell you, that gets created once, what, that and the automobile. I mean, how often do you have some type of industrial revolution like that?
All right, so we're in the office, we're in the workplace,
yeah.
a lot of people having jobs, maybe new people coming in.
Yep.
And, you know, they make movies about this. They talk about the old guy and the young boss
right.
or the old boss and the young worker. And so give me some ideas about how you get people from, and it's not just, you know, being a grumpy old man or a know-it-all young kid. It's different mindsets from when you grew up. I mean, if you're just entering the workforce right now, you don't know from the 90s.
Totally.
Really.
Well, I think the irony is it's not always grumpy old man and know-it-all young kid. Sometimes it's grumpy young kid and know-it-all
old man.
Right. And so the fact is a lot of people are parents, and if you get people into their 50s and 60s, they're grandparents. And now they've got these 20-somethings, and you've just got to embrace it. You've got to say, I want to learn and I want to grow. And if you retire too early, if you check out emotionally too early, and you're just going to check cash a paycheck,
right.
you're missing the boat here. This is a chance of if you're 50-plus and you have the chance to work with 20-somethings, you've got to view this. And I had this explained to me by a client of mine once. She said, I love working with young kids, with the 20-somethings, because it helps me be able to relate to my children. Right?
Yeah.
So look at, you combine your worlds and realize you're going to be more informative and more interesting to your own family, your own kids, by working with young people. So that's off the bat.
Has there been a time in our lives where the new workers, the younger workers, come in with the tools that the old workers don't have? And what I mean by that is just the technological awareness.
Yeah.
Of internet, of editing, of all of that stuff.
Well, I think it's probably just how you look at it. I think there's so much technology now that it's so apparent to us. But whether it was in the late 80s or early 90s and PCs were just becoming commonplace,
mm-hmm.
kids knew how to do it first.
True.
Parents, I mean, I remember my dad, you know, didn't know what a floppy drive might as well have been a coaster for a drink, right?
They are now.
Very well said. Yeah. So I think it's always that way, whether it was the typewriter to the computer, electric typewriter.
Someone had to learn the mimeograph machine.
They always learn, and the youngsters always learn it first.
Right. And that's a good point. So one of the things you recommend, though, is reverse mentoring.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I understand what that is.
So usually what you have is somebody who's been in the company longer mentoring somebody who's junior, and usually in most companies or career-wise, you have an older person by age mentoring a younger person and showing them the ropes. But there's no reason that you can't hire somebody who's got more years of experience for just that, for their experience, realizing where they're lacking and whether it's technologically or whatever, and to give them a mentor. And maybe you call it a mentor, maybe you call it a partnership, whatever the phraseology you want to use, but give them a young kid.
Right.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I tell you this, just I'm fortunate enough that I have an assistant to help me and a marketing team to help me, but to have there's certain kids, 20-somethings, millennials in my office that I go to because they're approachable to help me.
So who is it more difficult to get to adapt to the workplace? The young person coming in or the older person who has to realize how things are now.
I will tell you, I don't think it's either. What I think is, like everything else, it's on an individual basis. And so if you give more of the, you know, to, from your earlier comment of the grumpy old man, and you give him a really hyperactive young kid, it's right. not going to work. But there are passive, a little bit more calmer, more analytical young kids that you can assign to that person. And then on the flip side, when you've got somebody who's a high energy adult, giving them a high energy millennial, that can work really well as well.
You say that the most productive and innovative teams are those that share few characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. That they're diverse in their makeup. I was reading a book by a guy named Eric Weiner. In fact, he's going to be on the show next week. It's called The Geography of Genius. So he looks at different cities through history, and like Florence during the Renaissance or the Enlightenment in Edinburgh, mm-hmm. what prompted that? And one of the things he says is key is maybe discomfort, that things were tough. Paradise is bad when it comes to innovation. Is that what you're speaking to with teams? Maybe yeah. not so much.
No, but maybe not specifically in that way, but you get people, and it's not always, people always think diversity and they think black, Asian, white, woman, fit. I mean, right. there's so many different things.
So you're right. saying Cubs fans and Sox fans?
I think they can work well together.
I don't know right? about that.
But I do think that, I mean, it's somebody who grew up in rural America and somebody who grew up in urban America. It's somebody of a minority ethnic background, but it's also somebody who's one of seven kids versus somebody who is an only child.
Yeah.
There's a million different forms of diversity.
So that takes real management because you've got to, it's easy to set up a diverse team by race.
For sure.
It's harder to set up a diverse team by experience.
Looking at diversity as purely a race issue is a cop-out, and without getting political with you, right? I think that's part of the problem we have in the country, is that we look at it so based on color of skin versus where you grew up, how you grew up, economic background, diversity, two-parent household, one-parent household. But we look at those things when I hire. I look at only child versus youngest of seven.
You do?
Absolutely.
When you hire.
For sure.
That's legal.
I look at it as a conversation piece.
Right.
And it allows
me
to
figure out where people... I wasn't trying to bust you there.
But
I'm asking.
There hasn't been a case of somebody's been discriminated against because they're the youngest of seven children in a hiring situation.
Right.
Right? But it is funny. The youngest of seven, right, they're fighting for scraps at the dining room table. Right, the only child, they're having a 7-course meal laid out for them by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and obviously I'm exaggerating on both sides, but there's a certain personality trait that you have to do to keep up when you're one of many siblings.
And the key is to put that only child on a team with the youngest of seven,
and then you've got a little different view on the world.
Tom Gimbel is the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network. Thanks for coming by.
Always fun to be here. Thanks.
We'll see you again soon. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're here on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Kim will be back with a look at the numbers from Wall Street coming up a little bit later.
At the right time.
program.
So excited to give you the up numbers.
I know.
You know. I just jumped the gun.
And it's all good. Everything looks really nice on Wall Street, at least today. All right. So, you know, I guess it's a debate that just won't go away. Women in the workplace, working moms, are their kids better off if they're stay-at-home moms, or are they better off if their moms actually go to work? That's had the attention of Pamela Lenihan, and she's, in fact, even written a book. It's called My Mother, My Mentor, What Grown Children of Working Moms Want You to Know. And she joins us on a phone line now. Pamela, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, you know, I kind of thought this debate was over, but are you still seeing, I mean, you cite in one of your writings that there was a survey out recently that 60% of us think that kids are better off if their mom is not working than if they are working.
That's really true. And yet that doesn't match reality, because 70% of women who have children under the age of 18 are in the workforce, but no wonder they feel guilty if more than half of their friends, family, and colleagues think they shouldn't be there.
So what's your situation? Were you a working mom? Are you a working mom?
I have been working ever since my children were born, and I'm now the proud grandmother of five. So, yes, I've been working all this time, and my kids turned out great.
Well, so
I did most of the children of working mothers.
Well, I'm sure your kids are fine, but I think your grandkids could probably use a little more attention, Pamela.
They're coming this weekend.
Are they? Okay, nice. All right, so you to sort of explore this, you looked not at the moms of kids who are in school now, the working moms. You went to adult children of working moms to sort of get a handle on how things worked out. What'd you find?
Well, I did a survey of more than 1,000 adults, 23 to 44, and compared ones whose children, whose mothers stayed at home with those whose mothers worked. And what found is that the children of working mothers not only survived, but they thrived. And they said that they were proud of their mother, She provided a positive role model, gave them a strong work ethic, taught them resilience, helped them build confidence, and remain mentors long into adulthood.
So does this mean that the children of working mothers turned out better than the children of stay-at-home moms? Is that your argument?
My argument is that they turn out the same. I mean, you're going to make the decision to work or not work based on your personal situation. And I think we all know that all mothers work. Just some of us get paid for working outside the home. But if you do work, your children, the children in the survey report being just as happy, they have the same outcomes. They go to college at the same rate. They're employed. They have children at the same rate. And they feel that they're just as happy. So it really is not the factor of how your children are going to turn out, whether you work or not work. So I think working moms are doing a great job.
You know, it strikes me almost that you surveyed your audience in a way, because the children of working moms who you surveyed probably are working moms, or the husbands or the fathers of kids whose moms are working now. So in a way, you're trying to reassure the people who are already reassured.
Well, but the survey did compare the children whose mothers stayed at home with the mothers who go to work. Many more mothers are working today. In fact, in the 70s, only 47% of mothers were working, and today it's 70%. So if there are a lot of women in the workforce today who didn't have a mother who worked outside the home. So those are the women, I think, who are the most insecure. But the children who have been raised by working parents, they're more comfortable with it because they saw that it worked.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean that as an accusation. It kind of was a light bulb that went off above my head. So a lot of working moms today are the product of a stay-at-home mom back in the day. All right, so let's talk about some of these sort of qualities. I mean, you bring up the fact that resilience is something that these kids say they picked up from their working mom. What does that mean?
Well, I think what it means is that working mothers knew they weren't going to be there all the time, and so they had to prepare their children to solve problems on their own. So the children say their working mothers really prepared them better than the mothers who were there to help them along come at the end of the school day, for example. So it's just that these children felt that they themselves feel that they were better prepared.
Has there been any study done if you are the child of a stay-at-home mom? Are you more likely to be stay-at-home yourself? And I mean, I guess I asked that a little backwards, because if you are the child of a working mom, I wonder if you're more likely to be at work too.
Well, in my study, the daughters of working mothers were half as likely to stay at home. So
half as likely as the general. Okay.
That the daughters of mothers who stayed at home were more likely to stay at home, twice as likely to stay at home as ones whose mothers worked.
Do you get any pushback from stay at home moms or the children of stay at home moms?
Not really, no. I think that really people work because it's an economic imperative today. You need two incomes to have a nice house or to have the type of life for your children. And so I think people aren't viewing this as much as a criticism. It's really more of an economic decision.
Yeah, right. So I take some of the articles I've read of yours, and your book is maybe not making an argument for it, but almost a reassurance to those working moms.
That's really what I wanted to do, is just reassure mothers that if you're in the workplace, your children are going to be fine. And it's really using the time you have together for quality time. And I know that we all think that you need to sort of have some fabulous trip, but one of the favorite trips of the children was to the grocery store. So just use those simple errands you have to really enjoy being with your children.
Yeah, you know, it's true. If you think back during my childhood, the memory, I mean, I certainly remember the trips. I remember, I guess, the great times, but it's the ordinary day-to-day moments that are the ones that have the most impact. You cited a study, too, that said the daughters of working mothers are likely to earn more than the daughters of stay-at-home moms. Tell me about that.
Well, that's a Harvard Business School study, and they recently came out with a very large study. But in the United States, the daughters of mothers who worked earned 23% more than the daughters of mothers who stayed at home.
Why do you think that is? Is that what the book is about? I mean, the very argument you're making in the book?
No, I think that it could be that these are women who are just more comfortable in the workplace. And also, one of the reasons women make less than men is they are in and out of the workforce, whereas women who are consistently in the workforce are able to move up through the ranks and get to those more senior positions.
That's a great point. Sure. So the stay-at-home moms who are earning less, that might not be a reflection on their mom, but rather on their current in and out of the workforce situation.
Right.
You also found, what was it? I was just going to look at something else. Oh, the daughters of working moms tend to fare better than the sons of working moms. I'm not sure I get that one.
Well, I don't think it was fare better. I think it's that the the daughters are more influenced by their mothers. I think that we raise most men in our society, most boys in our society, to think that they're just going to work. And so having a working mother was less important to them, whereas a daughter sees both models in today's society. And so having a working mother made her more likely to work, and therefore she was more proud of her mother. She thought more about it. This was someone she associated with more than the sons did.
All right, let's go into the office, because I was reading some of the things you've written, and I've seen a few pieces that you've written for the Huffington Post. And when it comes to current moms, and whether or not you're going to decide to stay on the fast track, or you're going to be on the mommy track, or this track, or that track, you say that if you're having trouble, and correct me if I'm wrong, Pamela, but I think you wrote that if you're having trouble managing all of that, to talk to a friend or a relative, but don't necessarily go to your boss and say, I'm having a hard time keeping up.
I think that's true, and I hate to say that, but your boss might actually want to help you so much that you are managed off the fast track. And so if you're having a bad day, if it's really not the job for you, obviously you need to leave. But if you're just having a bad day, talk to a friend or your mother or your sister, because you don't want people to think that you can't manage all of this. There are going to be good days and bad days, but when you have those bad days, you need somebody outside your workplace to really complain about, or otherwise you're not going to get those increased responsibilities.
So that's an interesting reaction, because when I read that, I'm thinking, oh, because the boss is going to say she can't handle it. But you said that maybe the boss is going to try so hard to make it right that it's going to end up costing her.
Well, I think especially in today's economy, where there aren't enough people to go around for the good jobs, that a lot of times I've seen situations where you can't just assume it's a bad boss. In fact, often it's a really good boss, but the good bosses often try to help you so much that you don't get the experiences and the jobs that you really want. So I think that if you want to cut down your hours, that should be your choice. Don't make it your boss's choice because the boss thinks he or she's doing your favor.
All right, if you're a mom and you just left your workplace to run home and give lunch to your kids as they come home from school and you're feeling terrible about it, maybe pick up the book, My Mother, My Mentor, What Grown Children of Working Mothers Want You to Know. The author is Pamela Lenihan. Pamela, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve Alexander and Kim Gordon, Dolly McCarthy as well. We're winding down on this Friday edition, the last show of the week for the Wintrust Business Lunch. But not before we talk to Scott Kleinberg from the Chicago Tribune. He writes about social media, stops by a couple times a week. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
And let's go right to Facebook, because I thought, you know, they were saying Periscope was going to take over the world.
Yes.
And in my world, it hasn't. In your world, has it?
My world, it's definitely a player, but I don't know if it's taken over the world.
Facebook's getting into the act a little bit.
Facebook is, and I think Facebook has a lot of potential to take over the world in that realm. So their feature is called live video, and it's exactly like Periscope. You know, you can broadcast live, and it shows up in your Facebook feed, and then afterwards it's archived on your feed just like a normal post. And they at first announced it for just celebrities, and it was an uproar about that. Why just celebrities? Then they finally gave it to brands and to businesses and to other people, and then to verified accounts. And now they decided and they announced that it's going to be open to everybody. They said that was going to happen, but it happened quickly.
So I suppose the value then is, I mean, because you'd have to be watching someone's feed at the moment to see it.
To see it live.
But if it's archived, then you can check in any time.
Correct. Because if I go on the air now and I film us talking here, after we're done and I shut it down, it just shows up on my feed as Scott was live 5 minutes ago.
And that's up right now.
And yeah, well,
I mean, no, for us,
it's rolling out to people as we speak. But okay, it was just announced yesterday, so it'll probably take a week or two to get out to everybody. But it's in the U.S. and then it'll be international. But just the fact that everybody will be able to broadcast from where they are has the power to make it a Periscope killer, because it's so many people.
All right, tell me about these contactless ATMs.
So I've been hearing a lot about this, and I got a note in the mail the other day about how my bank is going to do this. And basically, it's saying you'll be able to use your phone to withdraw money. So you'll be able to go to the ATM, and you'll be able to enter a code and potentially get money if you don't have a card. This now is a level beyond that, where Apple Pay and Android Pay, where you can use your thumb to actually pay for stuff, they're going to bring those, or that's the talk, to ATMs within a year.
How does that work?
So that means you'd be able to, the way I see it happening, you'd be able to go in front of the ATM machine, and instead of having a card, your phone would recognize where you are based on something, information that you give. give it, and you'd be able to put your thumb, like on an iPhone, you'd be able to put your thumb on the center button, and just like you pay for Apple Pay at Walgreens or somewhere else, you'd be able to activate the ATM machine. You still have to use the machine, but you'd be able to activate it without having a card. So that
okay,
would
so,
make the
so,
machine much faster.
So what's happening is the phone is telling the machine that I'm there.
Yes, exactly.
But I'm still punching that I want fast cash or something like that.
Yes, exactly. And perhaps there'd be a way to do it on the phone where you can do all the transaction on the phone
sure.
and have it come out of the machine for sure. But now the way it works, obviously, if you lose your card, don't have your card, you're not getting money out of your ATM. The first wave of this would make it so you'd be able to use your phone and have a code and you wouldn't need your card at all.
I see.
The other wave basically says I could put my thumb down and do everything there.
All right, so I picked up on Spotify late last year and was just gonzo about it for a while.
Yep.
And missed the, you know, they had a deal for 3 months free.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I don't have the premium. I was going to do that right up until it was too late to do it.
Gotcha.
So I've kind of gone back to Pandora a little bit.
Okay.
But Amazon, I know I need to make a jump here. And there's Apple Music and there's Spotify, and now Amazon's going to try to jump over both of them, right?
Yeah, there's reports that they are trying to form their own music service, which is interesting in its own right because they already have Prime Music that goes with Amazon Prime. So if you pay for Amazon Prime, you get a million songs and you get this great service that already, you know, exists now. This, they're talking about doing a completely separate music service with its own separate fee and its own completely, you know, totally, you know, going against Apple Music, going against Spotify.
I hate to just follow all of these big companies, but I feel like maybe I should be getting into Amazon Prime. That's the one that you have Echo, right?
Yes. And you know what?
And that's the thing, you talk to the cylinder?
Yep. You talk to the speaker and yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're looking into this whole music thing, because they obviously have this great,
delivery,
you know,
device.
Thing. Yeah.
This device. Do I have to buy the cylinder?
Yeah. It's like $149, $159, something to that effect.
That's quite a chunk of change if I can listen to it on my computer with speakers and...
Yeah, but this lets you can talk to it and you can ask it questions and it can go on the web. So it's kind of like Siri in a speaker. So it's got a lot of potential.
All right. That's it. One more. We got a minute or so, but let's go back to Apple.
Okay.
That they're moving toward cordless charging.
Yes. They want to
next
come
year
in 2017.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. So wireless charging that does not necessarily, there's wireless charging now where you'd put your phone on a pad and it would charge. This is by distance. So my phone sitting in front of me right now could automatically charge over Wi-Fi without anything at all.
So I really wouldn't need to charge it.
You wouldn't. It would do it automatically. The further away you are from the device, the longer it takes to charge.
Who's charging it? The device I'm in, the computer I'm in front of?
I would say in that case, it's probably the system inside the phone that knows to charge it. So instead of having to plug it in and say, hey, I'm charging, it would automatically know based on
where
you are.
But I mean, it wouldn't just go by any sort of power source in front of any computer. You'd
have to have a home computer.
Or...
I think you would have to tell it which computer, or
okay.
You'd have to tell it, it'd probably be by your Wi-Fi network. So when you come home and you log into your Wi-Fi, it would automatically know where you are and therefore charge your phone.
Sweet. Scott Kleinberg, thanks for coming by today. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too, Steve.
And,
thank you.
We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds great.
All right. You're listening to The Business Lunch. We're here on 720 WGN. Bill and Wendy right around the corner.